Evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to program tonight from the Historical Society of Watertown. Just say a few words. Thank you for bearing with us while we raced over from the award ceremony that Watertown Savings just held, and the Historical Society received one of those awards tonight. And so we were all at a bunch of the councils were at that session. So thank you for bearing with us on that. The Society has these programs throughout the year and essentially quarterly, and we welcome you to these sessions and thank you. Tonight we have a special guest that John has spoken to this group a number of times. Tonight he has a special subject, the Great Fires of Watertown. And without any further ado, I don't want to hold you up any further. John?
Bob Childs, Carl Neugebauer, Joyce Kelly, and the entire Historical Society of Watertown. You guys have a great Historical Society. Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. My name's John Horrigan. Couple of announcements. I call them housekeeping notes. If you could please turn off your cell phones before we begin. We will have questions at the end of the lecture, although we're going to stop at certain sections if we... I'll deviate from that. I've asked Joyce Kelly and Marilyn Roach to chime in if they know where a particular fire took place and identify it with today's landmarks, because potentially we could have an outdoor fire tour at some point, maybe when and if the good weather ever gets here. My axiom, there's always someone in attendance who knows more about the subject than I do, and of course someone who thinks that they know more about the subject than I do. So I'll defer to both people. Are there any professional firefighters here tonight, active or retired? Great. Anybody from Watertown Fire Department? Wonderful. Way to go, Watertown. Fire exits, out the doors, to the left and to the left. Serious. Again, out the doors, to the left, get away from the building. If you want to talk to me or send me an email, johnhorrigan@hotmail.com. You can go to my websites, one of the 712 that I have, newenglandfolklore.com or johnhorrigan.com. Now, for the audio history, go to johnhorrigan.com/firewatertown.html. I have some certain audio recordings, one being the Paint Factory fire. I will put this particular lecture in MP3 format at that website. Give me about 24 hours to get that up and running, I promise, by the end of the week. But join the New England History Group at meetup.com. That's the history group that I chair, and we do all sorts of fun stuff. Just a little background on me. I'm an old New England folklorist. I've been called a rogue nostalgian, pocket historian. My agenda is the new popular public history, to bring a contemporary and invigorating view to American history, because if it were not for contemporary genealogy, then America would have lost her grasp of her grand heritage altogether. It's slipping away. We are the last defense. I've collected virtually every account of North American meteorological weather. I'm a weather nut, weather historian. My weather history stops at about the Great Hurricane of 1938. We will be speaking about that tonight. But I love early 20th century aviation, and I like paranormal phenomena and unexplained mysteries. So there's a bit of Indiana Jones in me and a bit of Fox Mulder, but without all the drama. And if I break out into a hockey announcer's voice, that's because I work with the Boston Bruins alumni hockey team, and I've been with them for 17 years. And finally, the New England History Festival. Love to have everybody here. My friends here at the Historical Society. We're heading towards our third history festival on, Saturday, November 14th at the Hibernian Hall. Who cares about this recession depression? So that's a log on to historyfestival.org. The past is a blast. My special thanks to start off right away, Joyce Kelly. Joyce is a counselor and editor of the newsletter of the Historical Society of Watertown. Did all the publicity. Her research, guidance, publicity, and of course her friendship during the compilation of this 100-hour project. I told Joyce, I don't have enough material to do a show here. I'm going to have to talk about the Great Fires of Boston. Well, I just told her that I have too much material. So I probably won't get to the Boston fires tonight. I have a wonderful display and demonstration on that, but I don't know if I'm going to get there tonight, and I apologize if you for the false advertising. Thank you to Carl Neugebauer, the president of the Historical Society, and all of the members, the counselors and members of the Historical Society here tonight, including Bob Childs. If you have not done so, stop by the Fowl House. It's the where the seeds of the revolution took place. Kay Westcott, Watertown Free Public Library, for her friendship, dedicated research, and she has an absolutely uncanny knack for finding data and information relative to my research and the research of my friends. I call her. Is she here? Is Kay here? Ms. Serendipity. There she is. And then Marilyn Roach, David Russo for finding photographs, the Runlett family. And the register of the engine company, Pequosset. See that word? Pequosset. There, I said it right. And for their great-great-grandfather, David Simpson, who was the deputy fire chief. Also to Michael Druckmann and my wife, Jenny, for giving me the 100-plus hours of research to do this. Thank you, Jen. And I've drawn from Michael Druckmann's wonderful book, which Joyce, by the way, is right over there. I'll give it to you. So we don't forget. This is the history of the Watertown Fire Department. Marvelous, marvelous book. Tonight we're going to talk about early firefighting, early firefighters, fire stations, and early fire engines. We'll go right through the centuries, talk about the great fires of Watertown, and then, time permitting, the weird side of Watertown. We've been plowing through old newspapers, Joyce, Bob, Carl, myself at the Fowl House, and we found some wonderful stories, Marilyn as well. Calendar shift, basically this text is, September 2nd was followed by September 14th in the year 1752, when they adjusted, when they went from the Julian to the Gregorian calendar. The Great Fires of Watertown, the most costly in history is the Lumberyard Fire of 1944, the Watertown Builders Supply Company fires of 33, 35, and 38, Soap Factory Fire of 26, the Paint Factory Fire of 1919, Sacred Heart Church Fire of 1912, and for the life of Joyce and I, we couldn't find anything about the Weston Biscuit Factory Fire. It's just a few ancillary comments about it. And then, of course, my favorite, which drew me to this entire subject, I love studying 19th century fires, the Great Fire of 1841. These are the settlers of Watertown. I won't go over them, but if you look in the left-hand column, there's John and Susan Furman and Dan Finch are involved in some fires here, and they are mentioned this evening. They are some of the original settlers of Watertown. In the early days of firefighting, there was the hand brigade. Every man was compelled by law to perform both fire and military duty. And again, I apologize up front. This is a text-driven lecture. Don't bother about squinting. I'll drive it through the narrative. I'm going to be reading verbatim some newspaper articles tonight, so bear with me. I can only put so many of those goofy moving GIFs that I had at the beginning of the presentation. A bed, a key, a wrench, a stout bag, about the capacity of a barrel, and two leather buckets were required. You formed a double line of men and women, you'll see that, between the water supply and the fire. It was the hand brigade. Bucket came down, empty ones went back out. So buckets were passed up one line and down the other. From the Watertown records and town proceedings, 1792 to 1809, some bullets here. March 28, 1791, the town meeting voted to procure a fire engine at the expense of the town, 17 pounds for said purpose. April 1792, voted the selectmen to procure a place and erect a building for the fire engine, to know if the town will procure fire hooks and other necessary implements for the fire engine. The fire department bought its first tub in 1795. February 1799, to know if the town will procure six pair of buckets for the engine, paid Thad Cole for service at the middle school high school for painting 12 buckets. March 10th, 1797, to Leith and Spur in full of their account for repairing the engine 5. Then were procured to repair it. March 1st, 1802, to know if the owner will procure a wagon for the use of the engine and act anything thereon. The fire department here at Watertown would lease out wagons and lease out horses from residents. The fire department bought a second tub in 1815, and 18 volunteers were assigned to it. Some of the early engines, and we'll see photographs of this in a moment. July 1832, Torrent No. 1 Company is formed when a small Hunneman hand engine is purchased. August 10th, 1842, another Hunneman engine is added and named Relief No. 2. The Torrent Company gets another Hunneman the following year, and it's sold to Lisbon, Maine in 1874. In January of 1872, Pequoset No. 1 is the first and only steam engine, it's a Jucket, and we'll see a photo of it in a moment, in Watertown is acquired. And she performed admirably at the Great Boston Fire of 1872, heretofore known as Damrell's Fire, being the unit that extinguished the embers of the Old South Church, helped out with the Square Fire in Cambridge, and Elliott Church and Coles Block and Elliott Block of Newton fires, all late 19th century conflagrations. Again, moving on, Governor approves the authorization of a Watertown Fire Department on March 14, 1855. So, Dave Smith, we're not even at the Civil War yet here. All horses owned by the department were quartered at the Central Fire Station headquarters on Church Street. The station on Church Street was replaced by a new central station at 99 Main Street, the corner of Cross Street, in 1906. In 1891, Hose Company No. 2 was established in East Watertown. And in 1919, no more horses were used. The first motorized engine No. 1 was operational. And as Joyce and I found in the newspaper, the last horse trough was removed in Watertown in July of 1934. I'm not going to go over all of these bullets, but you can just see some of these milestones. 1881, the 5th Department horses added. Remember, we're dealing with horses here. We're not dealing with mechanized devices. Yes, the steam engine was in use, but you're talking literal horsepower to move your wagons about. And you can see at 1919, when the first motorized engine No. 1 comes into play, post-World War I, it's all over for the horses, and the horses probably smile on that. This is what an 18th century firefighter would look like, very dapper with his boots and his hat and his emblem on his shoulder. I spoke at the History Festival about the Great Nantucket Fire in 1846, July 13th, 1846. Two competing fire departments got to the fire at the same time. Instead of putting out the fire, they slugged it out to see who was going to have the honor of putting out the fire as the town burned to the ground. This is the Hunnemann's and Company engine. It revolutionized it. Boston purchased one of them, and this is one of their early advertisements. And I will tell you that as I researched these fires in Watertown, No. 1, Watertown, I think, is the arson capital of the Northeast. And No. 2, and this has no relation to it, there was a rash of stabbings amongst Italian immigrants from the years 1929 through 1931. up top, 1852, May 1st, 1852, that's Hunnemann 450, procured by Watertown Fire Department. 465, the bottom, by they called it George Bomford, which was procured in December 16th, 1852. A Jucket and Freedman, I'm not going to read the text, but it was came about in 1869, post-Civil War. You'll see it, and this is where Pequoset 1 is relative to, with a big steam cauldron in the back. Here's Pequoset engine No. 1 of Watertown. For years, I guess it sat outside the Library of Maryland. It looks like that building there, Town Hall. Here it is, and this is a parade, 1892. This is the Memorial Day parade, which the fire department still proudly marches in. What a tradition there. Again, here's Pequoset 1 with some bells and whistles. It looks like there's some sort of lamp up top. This is, again, at the turn of the 20th century. Here's a hook and ladder. This is a ladder truck that was pulled by horses. You have your axe, and the ladders will be put on the side. Another steam engine here, the Hunnemann. Variation of the Hunnemann. Big drum of water. Water pressure is a huge issue fighting fires, as you know, in the 19th century and in the beginning of the 20th century as well. These are the Watertown Hook and Ladder. I believe that's 1901. Again, these photographs, Joyce, Marilyn, and David Russo came up with them. Again, the ladder. Here is the fire department. At first glance, they look like the Prussians in 1914, but if you look, you can see their helmets there. This is, again, at the turn of the century. Again, I'm racing through these because you don't want to know how many slides I have tonight. It would scare you out. You run for the door. Watertown's first steam engine. Again, it responded to the Boston Fire in 1872. What building is that? What am I looking at? I've only lived here 6 years, and that's why I'm deferring to the residents and the experts from the society here. Watertown Fire Society, some early station houses. The central fire station was occupied on May 1st, 1906. Department headquarters was on Main Street. Station 2 was at 564 Mount Auburn, commissioned September 1st, 1912. A locomobile pumping engine was the town's first piece of motorized apparatus purchased in 1912. There's a fire department building. Alberto Haynes was the architect. Alarms of water. The water department began laying pipes in the 1880s in Watertown. Hydrants were operational in early 1891. Water meters were installed in 1905. In 1899, fire alarm box system was introduced. In 1833, 25 alarms were recorded. And then you go 110 years later, 621 alarms recorded in 1943. The Metropolitan District Water Supply System was introduced. And it remained ineffectual for the next 90 years. I'm sorry. 1912, New East End Fire Station was built at 564 Mount Auburn. Some signals, not to go over all of them, but the first alarm will be given by striking three or more rounds. The second alarm will be given by striking two blows followed by the box number. Anybody want to explain that from the fire department? Yes, sir.
Inside the typical red master box that's located out on a telephone pole or a building, each box is specifically designated with a coded wheel inside. When it taps out the code, it goes into the fire alarm operator. The code will come up and he'll know exactly what the location is. Years ago, before they had telephones and radios, there's what they call a blow hammer. And that's how they communicated with the fire alarm office, because there were no radios. They would hit the blow hammer. In other words, if they wanted a second alarm, they'd hit two blows.
Oh, okay.
And they would retransmit the box and so forth.
Excellent. Numbers and locations of fire alarm boxes. One near you.
Hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully, right? Not to cruise through them, but we've got a lot to cover tonight. Again, Watertown's first steam engine. That helped in the first motorized apparatus, 1912. She could probably get upwards of 20 miles an hour, yo. Okay, now, from Divided We Stand by Roger Thompson. This is what I found fascinating, the history of Watertown. The Watertown Settlers, which was my fantasy football team's name, by the way. as the first winter came on, many were still living in tents, wigwams. In September of 1630, Watertown being settled on what date?
June 1630.
So one Finch of Watertown had his wigwam burnt and all his goods. 6 weeks later, in the chill of November, Furman of Watertown had his wigwam burnt. In 1632, settlers had primitive huts with wooden chimneys. Mr. Oldham had a small house near the weir at Watertown. And I wonder, do they mean weir? What is the weir? Everyone knew that except for me. I was doing a story about him. Okay, near the weir at Watertown, made all the clapboards burnt down by making a fire in it when he had no chimney. By the way, smoking was banned outdoors in Plymouth in 1623 because embers, people would be smoking, would go up onto the thatch roof, so you could only smoke indoors. How ironic is that? The use of open fires and poorly insulated, catted, or daubed wooden chimneys made fire an ever-present danger in the early days of Watertown's settlement. Several Watertown settlers suffered severe losses, spelling check, through house fires. When barns burned, like George Phillips or Nathaniel Biscoe's, and we'll get to Biscoe in just a second, cattle, both hogs and other bigger cattle, were much hurt for want of meat. And there was a grain shortage in 1631. So untested in unimagined environment, when they first came here, that first winter in Watertown saw attempts to grow winter corn. The crops failed as they were infested by pests, including passenger pigeons. And I want to get to that story at the end of tonight's lecture. It's a marvelous quote. So Winthrop and Biscoe. Governor John Winthrop had no use for one Biscoe of Watertown, who had his barn burned March 5th, 1643, which destroyed 200 pounds worth of goods. That's 1643 money they're talking about. That's a lot. Nathaniel Biscoe was a wealthy tanner and a noisy selectman in Watertown town meeting. He was fined £10 for circulating an anti-taxation pamphlet against the Protestant church. Here, here, Father Curran. His barn was on his property on Common Street near Belmont Street. Winthrop insisted that the fire was providential punishment for refusing to barter leather for corn to his neighbor. Whoops. Biscoe felt that the fire was an act of man and not an act of God, i.e. arson. So here's the first arson fire, he thinks, and I think because he didn't pay his taxes, they torched his barn. His son was mistreated at Harvard, and later he packed up and went back home to England in disgust. As late as 1657, Mr. Isaac Johnson complained that there was no fair compact in the town. The frequent burning over by the Indians had left the largest trees but no underbrush, and the country looked like an English park, perhaps as Waverly Oaks Park looks today. That was from Great Little Watertown. So now we get to the 18th century. Not much going on there in terms of fires that I could find. 1720, soon after the death of Reverend Mr. Angier, the town, which before the incorporation of Weston had been divided into three precincts, was redivided into two with independent ecclesiastical organizations, each society building its own house. The West Precinct, Mr. Angier's, purchased the old Newton Meeting House in 1721, which they set up a little north of Waltham Plain. The Eastern Precinct, Mr. Gibbs, in 1723, built their house on Schoolhouse Hill, afterwards known as Meeting House Hill, the ancient Strawberry Hill. Any idea?
Comet Street Hill.
This structure gave place to that built at the corner of Mount Auburn and Common Streets. In May 1754, before its completion, the new house was burned to the ground. The historic edifice in which were held the sessions of the Provincial Congress of Massachusetts, built in the same spot, was completed in February of 1755. Are they talking about the fowl house?
Yeah, the meeting house.
The meeting house, okay. Okay, good to know. Until 1827, this was the only meeting house in Watertown. It was enlarged in 1819, but was taken down in 1837. A new edifice having been completed and dedicated September 7th, 1836. This, then, was destroyed by the Great Fire of 1841. Unitarian church fires. In 1754, a church was erected on land given for the purpose on Mount Auburn Street, near the new burying ground in this town, but before its entire completion, May 1754, it was burned to the ground by some incendiary, another arsonist.
That's the same one you just talked about.
Okay, and then another church, etc., redundancy. The edifice itself was destroyed by fire in the great 1841 fire, so that's a bit of Groundhog Day redundancy. Ah, the first soap factory fire. And again, I'm drawing from Crossroads and the Charles, A History of Watertown, Massachusetts by Maud DeLee Hodges, Phoenix Publishing, 1980. Get your copy quick here, Watertown K, because I think you only have like 15 copies left on the shelf. That's a wonderful book if you want to learn about this town.
It's for sale at the Historical Society.
But you don't want to take it out when you can buy it from the Historical Society. And it can't leave the history room where it made. So circa 1820, about the same time the Robbins Soap Factory burned to the ground in a big blaze, which brought out the town's two-horse water tubs, manned by 18 volunteer firefighters. Refreshments were supplied by the town. Question, what was the refreshment?
Rum.
The town would vote years later to discontinue the practice of furnishing rum to firefighters at the town's expense. Methinks that's a good idea, looking back 200 years. Now, the Great Fire of 1841. In my research of the great 19th century American fires, I came across this one, and I keep finding more and more information, so I'm going to read the text. Bear with me. I'll drive right through it. On Wednesday afternoon at 1 o'clock, some argue just afternoon to 1 o'clock, July 21st, 1841, a fire broke out in a bakery and spread to the Unitarian Church. Dr. Francis's diary reads, "Our beautiful church is laid in ashes. The fire went on with incredible rapidity, and assistance was late in coming, so that it was impossible to save anything. I must say that I wept like a child to see a sanctuary so dear to my affections and bound to all my thoughts by such pleasant and hallowed associations going down in the flames." The Boston Traveler printed an account of this worst blaze in Watertown's history to that date. It said that a fire broke out in the bakery between midnight and one in the morning. There's the Herald, not getting it right again. The stables of the Spring Hotel also burned. At 3 a.m., the fire was still burning. Citizens appeared to meet the danger as lines of females formed soon after it began and were still passing buckets when the newspaper went to press. Mr. Leeds' bakery, the bakehouse and its barn, at the corner of Church and Main, that is right over here, right in the town, where the fire had started, was eventually rebuilt. For years after, it housed a little barber shop. Reverend Dr. Francis's Unitarian Meeting House had the organ insured for $15,000, and that was saved. Went up after sparks lodged in the belfry. It was a very windy day. The wind was blowing out of the southwest, and a shingle got and lodged itself in the belfry and burned it down. Later, the Spring Hotel was falsely identified by the Boston Traveler as Ground Zero due to an unextinguished cigar that was dropped in the hotel stable. Mr. Armagill insisted that he had put it out after several flare-ups. The meeting house of the First Parish Unitarian Church was eventually rebuilt in Victorian Gothic architecture and then subsequently demolished in 1975. Leeds Bakery at the corner of Church and Main Street was rebuilt, as I mentioned. Mr. Crehor of Waltham exhausted himself and would die shortly thereafter. So that's the only casualty. Waltham and Newton firefighters were on the scene. Now, over the past 300 years, all I see coming to Watertown's defense, and they went to their defense, is the Waltham Fire Department, the Newton Fire Department, and the Belmont Fire Department. So raise a glass to all three of those departments. They've helped out the Watertown Fire Department time and time again. There was $50,000 worth of damage. Meeting house was burned down. Three dwellings and two stables were destroyed, including Clark's store and Jay Lennox's house. The Boston Atlas, quote, "We regret to announce that our neighboring village of Watertown was visited yesterday afternoon by the largest and most destructive fire ever known in that town. It commenced in the bakehouse of Mr. Leith. The flames spread with great rapidity, and in less than 1 hour it consumed the bakehouse and barn belonging to Mr. Leith, three dwelling houses, the extensive stables to the Spring Hotel, and the Reverend Dr. Francis's Unitarian Meeting House. The meeting house was seated some distance from the fire and caught on fire from sparks lodging itself in the belfry. As I mentioned, the wind blowing from the southwest. The Spring Hotel, kept by Armagill, was on fire several times, but by great exertions was saved. The furniture was severely damaged." So that was the Great Fire of 1841. Magnificent flame. Made national news. If it had been at night, which it wasn't, I'm sure that the flames could have been seen from quite a distance away.
Excuse me, John.
Yes.
Wow,
cool. Where?
Where? Oh, nice to meet you, sir. Any cookies?
Oh, great. Awesome. That's great. That's why I like doing this stuff. Sash and Blind Factory Fire, February 9th, 1852. And again, I'm going to miss some fires. And you're going to say, what about this fire? As I told Joyce, I found out about the Starch Factory Fire of 1902. I found out at 6:05 tonight about this fire. Sorry, I missed it. February 9th, 1852. Gould & Company Sash and Blind Factory is destroyed by fire on a bitterly cold evening. Nothing is saved. I wonder if Johnny Pesky did commercials back then for them. He was probably in his early 20s. Sorry, I love him. Fires, 1855 to 1866. Bad fires in 1855 include the Spring Hotel and White's Shop. The fire department's operating expenses for the following year in 1856 was $1,375.44. What is it, up to, what, 20 grand a year now to run the fire? Bad fires in 1866 include the lumber yard of Royal Gilkey & Company, and we're going to be talking about this in just a moment, $10,000 worth of damage, and the U.S. Arsenal explosion and fire, $150,000 of 1866 dollars, and 150 feet of fire hose was burned. The manufacturing block fire, January 27th, 1857, a large building in North Watertown, and I just found out that's Belmont we're talking about, right? Or occupied by a great number of mechanics. The fire destroyed the building and also the large bridge leading to North Watertown. Guess who's going to go looking for that in the next couple of weeks? Marilyn. $20,000 worth of damage, $1,857. Remember, when you see the dollar totals, it's relative to the year of the fire. The building was uninsured. Now, the great arsenal explosion. This is what the arsenal looked like prior to the explosion. And I'm sure Dave has a lot of interest coming from the Civil War Roundtable of Boston. Dave, can you give me just a brief overview of how this serviced the North in the Civil War?
The Watertown Arsenal, along with Springfield Armory and Harpers Ferry, were three of the largest armories around and basically provided all the armaments for the Union Army. Richmond only had to try to go to Ironworks to supply their arms, and a fire like this did a lot of damage, so that they had to depend a great deal on Springfield and Harpers Ferry in the beginning.
Did Ulysses Grant ever visit here? Or did he go to Watertown, New York, or Watertown, Connecticut by mistake?
Yeah, he probably ended up in Watertown.
Okay. September 3rd, 1866. One of the wooden buildings at the U.S. Arsenal was full of munitions left over from the Civil War. The ammo dump, my term, included large quantities of saltpeter, which is potassium nitrate, sulfur, and gunpowder. An enormous explosion took place and was heard from 8 and 10 miles away, heard clearly in Boston. The building was demolished and adjacent buildings were shaken. Homes in the neighborhood suffered broken windows. Glass rained down on the lumberyard. The news that was received in Boston, must be the Boston Traveler again, was greatly exaggerated and told of a terrible carnage when only 3 or 4 people were seriously injured. Dave, did you have something?
No.
Okay.
I was just going to say that became the Boston Herald anyway.
Fires of 1868. January 1868, a fire near Etna Mills. The house and the store of Mr. Ed Dyer was entirely consumed. Also the stock of Berry and Kimball, which was a department store. $5,500 damage, 1868. December 2nd, 1868. A blacksmith and wheelwright shop of Otis Wheeler between Market and Arsenal Streets, adjoining building, was saved. December 30th, 1868, 8:40 p.m., the wool shop of John Hollis of Galen Street, heavily damaged, large amount of property consumed, water can be conveyed from water source up to 1,200 feet. So at this point, they can get a stream from 1,200 feet away. 1869, May 12th, Cameron and Ross Blacksmith and Wheelwright Shop, the Etna Mills Boarding House of May 17. November 13th, Humphrey Chadbourne's barn. December 18th, Henry Russell's barn, also attempted arson at Baptist Church. January 19th, 1870, Charles Kimball's store. The Russell Barn Fire, it took place on Spring Street in 1870. Herbert F. Bent and George Thomas G. Banks used small garden engines to put out the fire before the fire department showed up. So they were being very ingenious. They had their own private little engines. 1871, May 23rd, the barn of William Stone on Galen Street. $1,000 damage. What's in barns, everybody? You're going to see this as a continued theme. You got it. May, and they're made of dry wood. May 28th, a barn owned by D. Sullivan at Pleasant Street, $200. September 12th, starch factory on Starch Factory Lane, $4,000. Water Street? The barn of S.R. Payson on Belmont Street, September 17th. And that $5,000 he got from his insurance company, what was he storing in there? Gold? What do you think?
Now, Payson owned the Cushing estate. It was a huge estate. I'm sure it was a huge barn.
Oh, okay. That's why. Okay. September 18th, the barn of Mr. J.T. Ritchie on Bemis Street, $1,000 worth of damage. Okay, so, as I mentioned, it was Watertown that had a big role in the Damrell's Fire, the Great Boston Fire of 1872, which took place on November 9th and November 10th of that year. An amazing fire. I do have photos at the end, and I don't know if we're going to get there tonight. Maybe sometime in the future, if I talk about this, you want to come, because it's a magnificent fire. A great story, a lot of heroics, but I want to read this to you. So, fire department office, I'm looking at the right there. And there are some depictions down below. Dear sir, on behalf of the Board of Engineers of the Boston Fire Department, I beg to convey to the officers and members of your department, he's talking to Watertown, and especially to you as its chief, our heartfelt thanks for the assistance rendered in subduing the fire in this city on the 9th and 10th of November last. The promptness of your department in our great emergency and the arduous and heroic service performed by them will ever be gratefully remembered by this department and our citizens. I have the honor to subscribe myself, yours most sincerely, John S. Damrell, Chief Engineer, Boston Fire Department. And then what happened is Fire Chief A.D. Drew walked 6 miles to tender the services of his department to Chief Damrell. It was accepted, and he returned home when he secured a team of 4 horses. The engine, when they got, Watertown got there, Pequosset number 1, Old Faithful, arrived with them at the fire at 4:30 on Sunday morning, 4:30 in the morning. Okay, and the fire started just late on the night of the 9th. The engine located at Tremont and School Streets and threw 1,000 feet of hose played onto the transcript building and subsequently was the first to throw water onto the spire of the Old South Church. It later was down on Milk Street and it went to State Street and Broad Streets at 10 o'clock in the afternoon. So, way to go, Watertown. Help and save Boston. Incendiary fires. I kept seeing that. Incendiary fire. Arson suspicion. June 29, 1875, a house still under construction on Boyd Street, which is in the Morse Field District on the Newton Line. Anybody? Okay. Okay. Owned by C.R. Morrison. 7:30 p.m., the first of three alarms are sounded. A neighbor saw the fire and pulled the alarm. Moments earlier, two men were seen running from the house down the street. The house was foreclosed upon by Brighton Savings Bank. Ah, my, how times haven't changed, huh? The house of the neighbor who called the alarm in was engulfed. Fighting the fire was difficult as there was a lack of water and a hose burst, $4,000 worth of damage. Joyce gave me this one. Waltham Free Press, December 1876. A large barn of Mr. John Trickey, situated in the northerly part of Watertown, near the Waverly Line. Well, can you tell me what's Waverly?
Belmont, where the Shaws is.
Okay. Okay. You say potato. The fire was first discovered about 3:30, but the distance from the locality to the nearest fire engine being nearly 2 miles, together with the high wind and severity of the weather, so I'm sure that there's a high wind there in a nor'easter here. I haven't matched this up with my weather records, but I'm sure this is smacks of a nor'easter. Early winter nor'easter. There was no possible chance of preventing the total destruction of the building. Firemen responded. The barn was one of the largest and most costly in Middlesex County and contained, at the time, 13 head of cattle, 6 horses, 100 tons of hay, besides tools, grain, and farming wagons. And so quickly did the fire spread that it was impossible to get the livestock out, and everything perished in the flame. Sad. $10,000 worth of damage. But here's another one. And firebugs out there. The light from the burning building was seen at a great distance. And people would flock. You're going to see at the lumberyard fire, people flocking from everywhere, and one of the largest traffic jams in history. Hopefully I can get that. 1926 in Watertown Square due to the soap factory fire. Runlets aren't here, but basically they came to the Watertown Historical Society in the last few weeks, and they donated this book, which was called the... I'd make something up. I had it earlier. The History of Watertown Fires from the in the late 19th century, from their great-great-grandfather.
It's a log. Yeah, it's a log. Log of minutes.
A log of minutes, what expenditures, etc. And here are some selections here. On November 1st, 1881, there was an alarm of fire from Box 4 at 7:18 p.m. at East Watertown, a fire in a stack of hay against the ice house of Mr. Sawin. January 24th, 1882, there was a fire alarm in East Watertown, a fire in the greenhouse on Coolidge Ave. March 6, 1882, there was a fire alarm from Box 4 at 7:27 p.m. caused by a fire in the ice houses owned by Mr. Sawin on Elm Street. Mr. Sawin, you got ice catching on fire all the time. Second in 4 months. April 6, 1883, there's a fire alarm at 5:05 p.m. given by the blowing of the paper mill whistle caused by smoke proceeding from a house on Pleasant Street. So you can infer that they blew the paper mill whistle when they saw a fire. Here's a good one. September 12th, 1883. There was an alarm of fire at 12:52 a.m. caused by the burning of a house on the Adams Estate occupied by Robert Elder on account of there not being water. We had to sit on the wall and see it burn flat. December 5th, 1884. There was an alarm of fire at 11:24 this evening causing the burning of Howard Brothers ice houses on Watertown Street. Mr. Alex Flanders made the reel in his usual excellent manner. So he probably was the guy who reeled up the hose and did a wonderful job. Ice house is burning. Yeah. Alvin Adams Mansion Fire, and Joyce, you were mentioning something about another man. February 20th, 1885. It was one of the most opulent, splendid mansions in Watertown, located in East Watertown, formerly owned by philanthropist and entrepreneur Alvin Adams. Mr. Adams used to invite the public every Sunday in to see his impressive art collection. Well, he sold the mansion in 1884 to G.K. Foster. Foster sold it to a Mr. Warner, who apparently had money problems. Arson suspected, $30,000 total loss. Now, here's something I need your help. I pulled this out, and you tell me what we're talking about here. I have no idea what this is. March 11th, this shows up, 1885, in the New York Times. The fire, talking about Massachusetts here, the fire in Watertown Monday evening, March 9th, was attended by a phenomenon which attracted the attention of residents of all the surrounding country. The fire illumined the sky above it to a height, as seen from Cambridge, of 30 degrees or thereabout, which was not unusual. Above, however, in a direct line from the apparent center of the fire, and within 10 of the zenith, glowed a bright line of light. The phenomenon continued until the fire disappeared, and therefore may be supposed to have been connected with it. But in Boston, Lynn, Hyde Park, and other cities and towns where the existence of the fire was unknown, people were utterly unable to account for it. The prevalent theory was that a great comet had suddenly appeared in the Earth's atmosphere. What do you think we're talking about here? Here's the zenith, 10 off the zenith. I think we're talking about a bolide, a fireball. It's a little astronomy there. Came up in one of my searches in the newspapers when I put Watertown fire. So, the Carlton House murder, a spectacular murder case. I still think it's unsolved. Etta Carlton was murdered on March 18, 1885. It was a sensational murder case that made national news. A Negro named Cunliffe was accused of the crime. Etta was buried on March 21, 1885. The Carltons rented the house from Chase and Dorcas Langmaid. Dorcas is the poor woman's first name. On March 22, 1885, Mrs. Langmaid, Dorcas, went to add supplementary insurance on the house through the Shoe and Leather Insurance Company. She already had insurance from the Quincy Mutual Fire Insurance Company. Well, what do you know? A fire burned the house down on the following day, on March 23, 1885. In November of 1885, a court ruled that the Quincy Mutual Fire Insurance Company did not have to pay off on the policy, as arson was suspected. And then we get to one of my favorite ones, the Great Brighton Stockyard Fire. May 21st, 1886. And this is the only time I'm really straying out of Watertown, because technically it's Watertown. It depends. May 21st, 1886, 5:30 p.m. at the Boston and Albany Railroad Company in the massive stockyards. A large barn belonging to A.N. Monroe containing hay was almost completely destroyed, $5,000 worth of damage. The Brighton Fire Department responds. At 12:40 a.m. that night, an alarm is sounded from the same box, 567, when another barn with 80 tons of hay in the stockyards bursts into flames. The hay was as dry as the old barn, and an instant combustion took place. The steam whistle was sounded, and Cambridge then responded. Within 20 minutes, the whole length of the stockyard was engulfed, some 500 feet of fire. The Cambridge Fire Department defended the abattoir and some 15 cattle sheds from the flames. Three barns, 50 feet by 100 feet, enormous barns, each containing nearly 100 tons of hay, went up. 10 cattle sheds went up. Each had 65 head of cattle, and they were released into the streets, though, by the Cambridge Brigade. Moo! One of the burned barns had a capacity for 10,000 sheep, but fortunately, it was empty. Engines 29 and 11 of Brighton narrowly escaped as they were hemmed in between two burning buildings. The men were rescued by ropes. Some were badly scorched. Boston number 1, number 22, and number 10, chemical number 6, hose number 8, and hook and ladder number 12 took up strategic and advantageous positions. Watertown number 1 and Newton number 1 joined the fight. All apparatus could only throw a 30-foot stream because they had less than 10 pounds of water pressure coming through a 5-inch main. $15,000 loss plus $5,000 from the first fire. It was incendiary in nature. Western cattle drivers had been lounging around the yard, sleeping in barns, and giving police trouble. Many arrests of vagabonds were made previously. And again, you have the railroad there, so you had hobos coming through. There was a third fire the day before, which was May 20th of that year. That was seen for miles, by the way. St. Patrick's Chapel Fire. January 2nd, 1887. Pastor R.P. Stack had just left the church, and 20 minutes after 7:30 a.m. Mass, which still goes on today, around 8 a.m., a fire broke out. Actually, that was probably 7 a.m. Mass. He was saying a quick Mass if he got out that quickly. It burned in the eaves where the wall meets the roof. Bystanders, along with Father Stack, rushed inside the church to save precious valuables. There was $1,000 worth of damage, and a magnificent oil painting acquired from Rome of the crucifixion was lost. It was priceless. Again, back to the Runlet's Fire Journal. July 4th, 1887, a major fire occurred at Watertown, 1220 a.m. at the Holden House in Spring Street. Four alarms. January 24th, 1888, there was an alarm rung in from Box 12 at 3:40 p.m., the cause of which was to prove to a committee from the station house that we could get there on time, which we did. It was a test run. January 24th, 1889, a year later to the day. Legislator Committee on Towns wanted to witness an exhibition of a fire. One was deliberately set for demonstration purposes, and we played with it for 15 minutes. June 14, 1891, alarm of fire from Box 24 at 7:50 p.m. caused by the burning out of a chimney at Mr. Runlet's house in the Waverly District. August 14, 1892, the alarm box 5 at 3:40 a.m. was for the burning of a barn on School Street owned by Mr. Ralph Warner. October 24, 1892, Box 12, 6:41 p.m., a fire at Stanley's Dry Plate Works on Maple Street. And Halloween 1892, alarm box 15, 7:35 p.m., a fire in the house in Pleasant Street owned by a Mr. Lawando. Now we get to a slaughterhouse fire. The abattoir was owned by George Blyler, and it went up in flames on August 31st, 1891. We're in a chronology here, if you didn't know. Animal fat caused the blaze to be water-resistant. Finally, it was brought under control, $500 worth of damage, mostly broiled and charred meat losses. The darkroom fire, I call this. I named some of these my own title. November 6th, 1891. The block at the corner of Main and Spring Streets. Where's that? Probably walked by, and I probably walked right into the sign myself and bruised my nose. A fire began at 6:40 p.m. due to the closed flue of the chimney in the darkroom of a photography studio owned by F.T. King. It gutted the second floor and damaged the Republican Club. The first floor, where George E. Teal Hardware and Joseph Russo Fruit Company, we all know that, were located, sustained water damage. Although it caused $2,000 worth of damage, it was the first time in Watertown's history that hydrants were utilized for a fire. They were courtesy of the Watertown Water Supply Company. May 18, 1893, the Wallace Estate is destroyed. It was located at the corner of Myrtle and Cuba Streets. $2,000 worth of damage. Arson was suspected. Now we get firemen as firebugs. Yep. January 20th, 1897. The series of these fires, about a dozen, began on July 3rd, 1896, the previous year. Patrick Clark, who was a full-time firefighter, John Doyle, who was a substitute firefighter, and John Glenn, who was known as a hose house loafer, he was a substitute. So it's January 15th, 1897, and Doyle, the part-timer, who's being watched by police, runs into Coe's drugstore asking for a key to the firebox. And he couldn't get the box open. It was very cold that day. So he left the key in it and ran away. Moments later, a spinach shed caught on fire. Clark ran over, tried to put it out, and a witness said that, "Hey, I saw that guy leave the shed before the fire." Clark was detained and under intense interrogation, quote, broke down and cried like a woman. That's what it says in the newspaper. And confessed to all the fires. He ratted out Glenn and Doyle, my term, and admitted that he burned down Mr. Carroll's shed in August. Glenn and Doyle broke down and they cried like children, that's what the article says, and admitted to burning haystacks, sheds, carriage houses, carriages, and carts. Hennessy's barn was burned and a prize cow was lost along with a calf. A hobo had been sleeping in the loft at the time of the fire and was badly burned. He was originally accused of setting the fire, but the hobo said that before he went into the barn to sleep that night, he had seen three young men go in and then come out. A man named Powers told police that he had seen three young men running from a burning shed on Mount Auburn belonging to a Mr. Carroll. He found a bottle of turpentine at the site. And one of the telltale signs was accelerants were always found at the scene of these suspicious fires. So, one of these devices found in Glenn's room was a candle attached to a wooden board with a rag wrapped around its base. You know, you light the camera, you put the accelerator, and the candle burns down, boom, it's time to get away. And again, you know, we talk and we have fun, but let's never forget the tragedy of fires. And 1901, two babies lost. Quote, November 17, 1901. Two young children were burned to death in a fireman's hand, almost severed in a fire here tonight at 5:30, and did little more than 1,500 damage. Jenny and Francis Kendall, 5 and 4 years old respectively, were left alone in the house for less than 5 minutes when Mrs. Kendall went to a neighbor's house to borrow a bottle in which to get some milk. And when the mother returned, the lower part of the house was in flames, and the children could be heard screaming in agony as they fought with all their tiny strength to win away to freedom and safety. Mrs. Kendall heard a call of fire and rushed to the window of the house and was hardly 25 feet from her own abode and saw clouds of smoke and tongues of flame coming from the windows in the dining room. With set lips and pallid cheeks, she rushed from the room in a moment and was before the door of her own house. Close behind her was her friend, and they pushed the door open and tried to pass inside to rescue her babies. The smoke was stifling. The flame was stifling. She heard the cries of the pains of the children. Eventually, they find the children, and Watertown firemen arrive, and the children were found lying together on the floor of the dining room, burned almost beyond recognition. Beside them lay the fragments of the big kerosene lamp that had been left lighted on the table when Mrs. Kendall stepped across to the next house. It is believed in the excitement of their playing or the desire to reach for something on the table that the lamp had been pulled to the floor, setting the fire to the girls' fluffy white dresses. A factory in 1903, the plant of Porter Manufacturing Company, bad fire. There was $25,000 and $30,000 worth of damage. It was about 10 o'clock when the first alarm was pulled. Two more alarms were pulled. Assistance came from Newton. Took about an hour to fight. This was a three-story wooden structure 100 feet long by about 60 feet wide with a brick L in which the company had a machine shop for making shuttles for sewing machines. The loss will not only fall on the company, but will rest also on a number of employees who will be thrown out of work. They think that it was incendiary origin. July 4th, 1904. Fire scare last evening. Quite a number of Watertown people were excited last evening at the blaze which appeared in the sky to the northwest about 9:30 p.m. The police sergeant was kept busy answering calls from excited people who believed the fire to be in Watertown. Sergeant Lyons calmed their fears by telling the anxious ones that it was nothing but a bonfire in Water, Waltham. Big barns burning. Big barns burning. Big barns burning. Big barns burning. Just after noon on Saturday, December 4th, 1904, two big barns at Henry S. Harris Estate on Waverly Street lost along with a horse, pony, cow, carriage, and other contents. Inside of 30 minutes after the alarm was sounded, the barns were gone. Due to high winds, several houses on Waverly Street and two on Hawthorne Street were lit on fire by lighted shingles from the barns. Where is that now? Firemen did a great job containing the blaze, $8,000 worth of damage. Now here's, someone called the Waltham Fire Department posing as the chairman of the Board of Selectmen, T.W. Davis. Davis was miffed. It wasn't him. He spent the better part of the next year trying to search out and accusing people who used his name. The brush heap was the ignition source. Some people suggested it might have been the B&M engine from the noontime train that passed by, or was it just a careless landscaper? Another firebug. A paper of October 10th, 1905. 2 weeks of fires. They began in late September of 1905, continuing into the first 2 weeks of October. And this is what the firebug is a dangerous degenerate, the state fire marshal declares. State Fire Marshal Rice yesterday offered a unique opinion regarding the identity of the firebug, who for 2 weeks has been busy at work in Watertown. Mr. Rice, together with the local fire chief and the police, yesterday spent the day investigating the fires, and as a result, the state officer said, quote, "The work seems to me like that of a degenerate, a man probably sane on most subjects, but possesses a peculiar mania for setting fires and then calling out the apparatus. We have no clue to his identity, and the only thing we can do is to maintain a careful watch over the property and neighborhoods which have been the scene of these fires." So, and you can see the different areas, Arsenal Street in North Beacon, if you can see that, where the stock market was located, and 28, there's a house there that was lit. You can see the different sheds in the stock market where there are numbers located.
Stock
numbers. Dow Jones. Did it go up today?
Yeah, 3 points.
Yeah. 3 points. Yeah. Score. All right.
Richard did, John.
Yeah. That word will drop out of the lexicon of America. Oh, the Cat Fire of 1907. Tragedy. When everything was said and done, the Christmas tree was still standing in these poor people's home. This paper is December 28, 1907. A family of five, John Clark, his wife, his two sons, Philip, aged 8, John Jr., 10, and young Doris, aged 2. John Clark worked for a seed company in Faneuil Hall. Basically, the fire starts. I'm going to cut to the chase here. a neighbor sees the fire and knocks on the door, tries to get in the door. The door is locked, goes back across the street, calls out another neighbor. They get their ladder to come to the house. Mr. Clark was a heavy sleeper, apparently. They could hear Mrs. Clark screaming with the baby in her arms. She's her body's found with the baby clutched in her arms. Clark is found with his two sons, his arms face down over his two sons. Apparently, they were asphyxiated. Not to get into the gory details, but they think that, well, I'll tell you what they think. The little place is at the corner of Belmont and Hovey Streets.
Hovey.
Where's that?
Without
my GPS, I, honestly, I couldn't get it.
North
Watertown. North
Watertown,
okay. Okay. And why did I call the Cat Fire? And I seriously doubt this, and you can see some. Okay, what they say is that the cat was chasing a mouse in the Clark home and upset a lamp. That's what they think happened, and that the cat started the fire. And you can see where the mother and Doris in the central picture there were located and where they found the father and two children. But an absolute tragedy. 1910, this is the third big fire of the season. This is at the Union Carpet Lining Company on Arsenal Street, $15,000 worth of loss. The fire was caused by steam pipes becoming overheated and igniting some bales of Excelsior that were stored in the warehouse. The fire was discovered at 6 p.m. by Mrs. M.J. O'Donnell of Brookline. She was visiting her father, Mr. M.J. Keneally. And the second alarm... Chief Hatch ordered a second alarm, and he rang in for Newton and Brighton. The second alarm brought all of the Watertown apparatus, which had hardly reached the scene, when another alarm was rung in from Box 14, where a fire had started in the house of Mr. Waldo Learned. And realizing that he couldn't spare part of his force, Chief Hatch telephoned Newton, and the steamer and hose number one of that city responded to that call. While the fire was at its height, Hatch was directing his men from a small balcony surrounding the burning storehouse, and he fell 5 feet to the ground, striking against a hose wagon. Although hurt, he refused to retire, and a few minutes was at work again. Later, he was overcome by smoke and carried home in the patrol wagon. Grain Elevator Fire, August 7, 1910. This is the biggest fire in years. It's a grain elevator of Loring & Company near Arsenal Street and close to the Union Market Station. In the Boston and Maine Railroad was burned to the ground, $2,500 worth of damage. It was the largest and most destructive fire that Watertown has known for years. And you see that a lot with all these great fires, they say that. The Watertown Fire Department couldn't handle it alone. Three large engines were sent out. Fire smoldered in large bundles of hay and occasionally burst into flame nearly all day Sunday, keeping the firemen busy. No cause of the fire. They think that spontaneous combustion was the cause. An engineer in a passing train about 7:30 Saturday evening first discovered the fire, noticing the reflection of the blaze on the elevator windows. With his whistle, he gave the fire signal and attracted the attention of several railroad men who rang in the alarm. The fire was a most brilliant one, illuminating the sky far and near and drawing crowds of people to that vicinity. A large crowd gathered near the scene, completely blocking travel on the electric car line, and which was very conducive to accidents, and several people were slightly injured in the rush and excitement of the occasion. And I always see my name in some form. Mr. Edward Corrigan of Hook and Ladder, number one, was injured while removing horses from the stable and was sent home in a carriage. Okay, now, those naughty boys at the Commonwealth Motor and Driving Club, they get raided in July 8th of 1910, it was a motor club at Saturday night, 11 o'clock. The Commonwealth Motor and Driving Club, located at 300 School Street, was raided, and gaming implements and $500 worth of liquors were seized. The raid was conducted by Chairman of Selectmen P. Sarsfield Cunniff and Chief of Police Daniel Cooney. They're assisted by Patrolmen Milmore, Sullivan, Brown, Burke, and Glidden, who made a thorough search of all rooms, and they came away with the following. 19 half-gallons of champagne wine, 5 half-gallons of whiskey, 14 gallons of lager beer, 1 quarter gallon of gin, half-gallon of gin, 2 gaming tables, 17 chairs. Chairs are illegal at this time. No, sorry. 1 roll top desk. Now, wait a minute, guys. How'd you go a little too far? 96 packs of cards. Wow. 22 broken packs of cards. 283 chips in a rack. 433 chips in paper boxes. 2 chips in chip boxes. And 11 eye shades. The raid may be seen as well planned and conducted. You think? And so, Frank J. McPeak, the owner, the superintendent, was in Reno at the time to witness the Jeffries-Jack Johnson fight at the time. So anyways, they're busted, okay? And also, the Oakley Golf Club, that place catches on fire. I mean, that's going up. Oh, I don't have time to put on all the times that thing was burned down. I mean, throughout the last 150 years. But so the Commonwealth Motor and Driving Club is fined $100 in Waltham District Court, okay? And then, in August, a month later, they lose their charter. The Secretary of State announces that the club is no longer incorporated. What do you think is going to happen? No, yeah. January 13, 1911, 4 departments are called out. The distance of the hydrants handicapped the building. Raided on November 15th, as I mentioned. An MIT professor saw the flames at 6:50 p.m. The caretaker was not present, and the house was unoccupied. The box 32 was pulled. 800 feet of hose, but a weak stream. The Newton engine broke down. Chief Ramblett jumped on another engine. Belmont had no truck, just a hose wagon. They joined in. It was 25 of 48 rooms destroyed with solid hand-carved mahogany. The elite of the state used to gather there. A Belmont ladder arrived and tipped over, flung a firefighter who bounced off of an awning, which saved his life, and he only suffered a sprained leg. Something out of Hanna-Barbera cartoon. Well, there you go. So it was burned down, and these things happen. Beautiful, though. Too bad. This guy, O'Hearn, John O'Hearn, and again, how are we doing on time here? I know that I'm... What, 10 after 8? All right, I gotta bring it on home here. So much more. John O'Hearn, great firefighter. This was a firefighter. This guy knew about fires and knew what to do. Here we go. Sacred Heart Church. First Cornerstone, Father, 1893, was it, Layden?
Yes.
Yeah, 1893. And it did $75,000 worth of damage in the Sacred Heart. Happened on February 10th, 1912, actually, is when it happened. And it was discovered... by the janitor, I believe, whose name was Hogan. Here we go. Mr. John Hogan. There you go. See? Serendipity. John Hogan. Smelled smoke and upon an investigation found a slight blaze under the wok where the furnace pipes were located. He at once called Father Thomas Coughlin, the pastor, and his assistant, Father Richard Splane. Together, the three worked hard to extinguish the fire, but Hogan was hurriedly sent to ring an alarm, to which the department quickly responded. Fortunately, the extremely cold weather had not frozen any of the hydrants, and Chief Hatch at once got several streams into action. But he realized that assistance was needed, as surrounding property was in immediate danger, and asked for aid from surrounding cities. Cambridge, Newton, Boston, each responded with a steamer and hose cart, and Belmont sent its apparatus but could not aid the work because of inadequate length of hose. To all out, however, was that them to suffer frostbite, for which they were treated at the parochial residence by the doctor's trainer in Cunningham. In a few minutes, all of the men were encased in ice. Chief Hatch had 3 fingers of his hands frozen to an extent that incisions had to be made in them. And unable to attend his work because of frozen fingers, and Captain Macklin was cut by a falling piece of slate. No one escaped the blighting touch of the bitter cold weather. They deserve the greatest praise for their promptness and the energetic and persistent effort which they brought forth under such trying circumstances. So it's the last payment was made to Father on December 4th, 1905. The loss was estimated at $75,000. Here's some photos that Joyce pulled up here. Look at the...
Father Curran.
Oh, great. Thank you, Father. Look at the icicles there. Frigid day. In fact, that's one time where the intense heat is actually benefits the firefighters. The following day, Gawker's. Again, the ruins.
It was a Charles Brigham building.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. There you go, right there. Another church fire here. 1917. A girl leaps with a baby from the fire. Two children are rescued at Watertown Blaze. I'm going to just give a cursory glance at some of these just to get to some of the good stuff. The Great Paint Factory Fire. Sir, you stand up, please. Your house is built where the Great Paint Factory was. It happened just before 11 o'clock on Saturday evening. Chief O'Hearn immediately... You sit down now, there, but we salute you. Chief O'Hearn immediately recognized the danger, inflammable materials, and called for help from surrounding departments. So in the time of where fire departments... would have egos, and they wouldn't want the help from surrounding departments. This guy always called out surrounding departments to bring them in to help them out. There were great explosions and fusillades of sparks. Nearby houses were in grave danger, but heroic actions by Waltham, Newton, and Belmont, along with the Watertown Fire Departments, saved the neighborhood. Small, incipient fires ignited by floating sparks broke out, but were contained. The spectacular glow brought hundreds in autos and on foot from miles around. The building was a three-story wooden structure 250 feet long. The manager, John Meehan, saved the company's record books and a light auto truck. There was fear that four embedded gasoline tanks would explode, so many evacuated the neighborhood, but they doused it with great quantities of water. A second fire broke out 24 hours later on Sunday, and there was heavy smudge all day Monday from the debris. Don't know what that means. Is that smoke? Is that the scent? $40,000 worth of damage.
Where is that? Where is the...
It's on Cushman Street.
A fair, okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Tomasetti Block Fire. I used to live there, so that's why I'm bringing this one here. 2:38 a.m., Chief O'Hearn sounds three alarms. Newton helps out. It begins in the offices of lawyers, figures. Sorry if I offended any. No, not. Freddie Critchett and Tomasetti on the ground floor. Cause unknown. E.W. Heffernan, a night watchman, lived there. He smelled smoke, investigated, and like a good night watchman, he went back to bed. Occupants of 78 Main Street were driven from the building and taken to safety by police and firemen down fire escapes and stairwells. One man, an H.K. Hyatt, suffered smoke inhalation. An exceptional firefighting job done to save the building. Many curious residents came out to the square to watch. $4,000 worth of damage. And I don't live there anymore. Lively blaze at Bemis. This is just basically a factory's fire at Bemis on July 28, 1919. The Brunsine Manufacturing Company on Pleasant Street. When a boiling cauldron of cement boils over. Again, I'm just picking up the pace. 1926, the Warren Soap Factory. $54,000 worth of damage on June 29th of that year. The most spectacular blaze here in years. It also threatens car barns and other property due to the accelerants and the flammable goods that were involved there. Thousands of people flocked to witness the illumination, causing the worst traffic jam ever in Watertown Square. Yeah? Yeah, I mean, wait till you get a load of some of the days out there. You're right. So, I have to go here. So, I'm not going to... I had a big baseball thing laid out here, but the salt and the swat. Basically, he began as a pitcher in 1914... led the Red Sox to World Series championships in 1915, 1916, and 1918. Sold by Harry Frazee on December 26, 1919 to the Yankees to finance his Broadway show, No, No, Nanette. The White Sox offered shoeless Joe Jackson $60,000, but he turned him down because Jacob Rupert, who used to call Root, you big ape, he used to say, call Ruth. But he gave him a $300,000 loan. People don't know it, but I talk about Ruth. He was late in the 1933 season with the Yankees. He was called upon to pitch in a game. In fact, he won five games as a pitcher with the Yankees. You didn't know that, did you? And he stole home 10 times. And incidentally, he hit 714 home runs for what that's worth. But on July 18th, 1921, at Navin Field in Detroit, he hit a 575-foot blast. And, of course, his called shot, which I've seen the video, he's yelling at the pitcher. He's not pointing out to center field. 490 feet. Anyways, Asked by a reporter what he thought of his yearly salary of $80,000 being more than President Hoover, $75,000, he said, well, I had a better year than Hoover did. His last, people, did you know he finished with the Boston Braves? Yeah. Yep. And he hit three home runs on May 25th. Three home runs. One of them was a shot that cleared the roof at Old Forbes Field, and he became the first player to accomplish that feat. 5 days later in Philadelphia, he struck out in his last major league game, hurt his knee. 2 days after that, he called reporters to his locker and retired. And then this newspaper headline, the Boston Post, January 14, 1929. Mrs. Kinder of Watertown is found dead in a burning house. It's Friday on the 11th of January. She's married to a dentist by the name of Kinder. They lived in Watertown for about a year and a half. Apparently, they got married in Montreal sometime in the year 1928. Helen died of asphyxiation from a fire that started under her second floor room in a partition due to overloaded electric wiring. Her mother, brother, and two sisters lived in South Boston and were immediately notified. The sisters came to Watertown to identify the body. Mr. Kinder was at the boxing matches at the Boston Garden. Helen had a cold and declined to go with him that night, and he got paged from the boxing match and was told that his wife was injured. He collapsed and then went into seclusion after learning of the devastating tragedy. A passerby sounded the alarm. A fire captain and a policeman fought their way up the flame-swept staircase when they were told that a woman was inside. She was found face down in her nightgown on the bedroom floor. She was still alive when they brought her out, but she died at a neighbor's house before a doctor could arrive. Babe was notified Saturday morning, January 12th. He arrived in Watertown on Sunday, January 13th. He was visibly shaken when he got off of the train at South Station and went with his good friend and attorney, John P. Feeney, to the Hotel Berwick. It was then that Ruth was told that she was married again. It stunned Babe because he said they weren't legally divorced. His statement, and this is very cold, quote, I have not lived with my wife for 3 years. In that period, I have only seen her a few times. I have done everything to comply with her wishes. Her death is a great shock to me. That is all I wish to say. He read it off of hotel stationery and his voice quivered. He said that he thought that Helen still lived with her family in South Boston where she went after their separation. They were married in 1914 when she was 16, and they lived in Sudbury until he was sold to the Yankees in 1920. Babe met her at Lander's Coffee House where she worked as a waitress on Huntington Avenue in the Back Bay. Their daughter, 9-year-old Dorothy Ruth, was known in Watertown as Dorothy Kinder. She attended a private school in Weston. Well, Helen avoided the spotlight. Babe was the most popular person in the world after he broke the home run record in 1920-54. Rumors of an impending divorce due to Babe's carousing surfaced in 1922. That year, Babe showed up in the Yankee clubhouse with a baby girl called Dorothy. Babe told the press that she was born on February 2nd, 1921 at Presbyterian Hospital. Helen told the press at the same time that she was born on June 7th, 1921 at St. Vincent's Hospital in Worcester. When this was pointed out to Babe, he said that he confused his birthday with hers. Of course, Dorothy's real money was mother was Babe's mistress, Juanita Jennings. Babe Ruth's other daughter was Julia Ruth, born in 1917 to the actress and model Claire Merritt Hodgson. Do the math, he was still married to Helen. She was 12 when her mother married the Babe in April 1929, his second wife. Helen had several major operations and only appeared with Babe in public occasionally. She suffered a nervous breakdown in September of 1925. That was when Babe was suspended for violation of team training rules, and then they sold the farm in Sudbury and they agreed to part ways shortly after that. Here's Babe with Dorothy. Babe's Louisville Slugger sold for $1.26 million. Slightly less than the Jonas Wagner 1909 baseball card. Mohawk Pete's fire, November 2nd, 1930. I'm going to go a little faster, folks, just to get us out of here and get some good stuff. Basically, Mohawk Pete was Pete Feinberg, his tire and battery store, acidic smoke in the air. The firefighters required gas masks due to the burning acid and the vulcanized rubber permeating the air. The mushroom plant fire, it was discovered by James Phelan, the vice commander of the American Legion. Suspicious origin, heavy smoke, spectacular flames. The visiting chiefs leaving their shift, and I think maybe in Belmont and Waltham, there are two chiefs, saw the glow in the air and came to the fight. $12,000 worth of damage. The Strand fire here is Chief O'Hearn took time to write and tell how proud he was of his fire department and the fight they put up for the April 20th, 1931 conflagration with the Strand Theater. In fact, he wrote to the paper, the Watertown Tribune, about how proud he was of his men. Weston Biscuit Factory, as I mentioned, it's called out as one of the great fires of Watertown, found no data except that it was $50,000 worth of damage and located at the corner of Howard and Acton Streets. False alarms, a legacy of buffoons. A girl gets locked out of her house. She pulls the fire alarm. A fire department comes out on a rainy day. She is reprimanded by the police. The builder's supply fires. Chief O'Hearn's going home at 9:59. Going home early for the chief, by the way. That's leaving early. On October 13, 1933, the blaze lights up the sky. Sparks threaten the arsenal across the street, and a small force, an army force, came out of the arsenal to protect it. The height of the flames hampered the firefighters. Firefighters flooded the building, brought it under control. Burning wires dangled over Arsenal Street. The power was cut by Edison and Watertown wires, disrupting telephone, wire services, police communication, and lighting until the morning. Spontaneous combustion. A cold fire on a record-breaking cold day below zero, December 29, 1933, at 273 Boylston Street, burned out the pharmacy, the First National stores. Some of the businesses, like a barbershop in the block, stayed open, a tailoring company during that. The streetcars were held up for 2 hours while it was fought. A terrible snowstorm, a two-footer, fell on January 24, 1935. Cars were abandoned in the middle of the street. Galen Street, Arsenal Street, Mount Auburn Street, a furnace set on fire. Fortunately, it was on 125 Arsenal Street, and the firefighters could get there to fight it. A fruit company fire, Henry Kokotoff, leaves the store on Saturday night, January 26th, and just before midnight, a fire sparks out in the rear, $800 worth of damage. Another building supply company fire in 1935. This was another spectacular one that drew out the masses who came to stare at the fire. Gilbert Nichols, this is a man who served 49 years as a Watertown firefighter. He actually had to put out his own house that caught on fire. When he began the force, there were three men. By 1931, there were 47. He fought the Wareham Street Fire in Boston, which was a famous fire in 1891. Fought the Soap Factory Fire, but he died at a fire at 19 Moore Street. Do you know where that is? Yeah, in 1935. Firefighters inflate cap balloons. I only included this because I was very frightened of the lower cap to the lower right. I swear. Motorists revived after 25 minutes of submerged car. The firefighters had to get this clown out of the Charles River. Hurricane of 38, September 21st, 1938, went through Watertown. Howling wind blasts hundreds of trees, darkens homes and stores. They called it and said it will forever be referred to as the Day of the Big Wind. First time I've ever heard this thing referred to as the Day of the Big Wind. The town clock stopped at 9:05, and I say it had to be at night because the hurricane hit at the close of the workday. Electric current shut off at 5:30 p.m. 50-cent flashlights went for $3. Candles sold out instantaneously. 50 buildings were damaged. 2,500 trees were uprooted. $150,000 worth of damage. 150 instantly unemployed. Roofing, plumbing, tree surgery, and building trades flourished. 300 instantly employed. 68 calls were answered by the department, mostly flood-related. Casualties, Carlton B. Smith of 30 Arden Street died of a fractured skull from a falling tree. Permanent firefighter Ernest B. Ford died on January 2nd, 1939 due to injuries suffered from the hurricane. Other people critically injured. There were two men and the American Legion Post 99 sent volunteers to help out. Some scenes of destruction, demolished porch of church in Fayette Streets, upper left, upper right, uprooted trees in front of M.H. Reed home, Marion Road, lower left, demolished garage at Marion Road, and then a scene at the library on the right, lower right. Milk industry caused heavy losses. Next day, they had to put it up on September 23rd, and they spent weeks to get the town rewired. Burning brush. Debris left by the storm was consumed in huge pyres. People dragged the brush, and what do? They light it on fire. The chicken fire, 1938. 3:28 in the morning, a needless alarm is pulled at 612 Main Street because they saw the glow of the flames. The owner is John P. Quirk, who lived on 57 Quirk Street. And he's also a firefighter who's on duty at the East End Fire Station when it happens. 200 chickens are lost, $300. Quote, a distinct scent of roasted chicken permeated the air in the area the following morning. Ice cream fire again, ice cream factory, 1939. The lumberyard fire, 1944. This is January 2nd of 1944. This is one of the most spectacular fires. Crackling flames, 40 feet skyward, lit the night sky for 20 miles, bringing more than 2,000 spectators to the scene. Anybody know how this started? Small boys confess they lit matches in a shed. $150,000 worth of damage. And, of course, this it started at 6:20 p.m. And down the bottom, moral, teach your boys not to play with matches. And they threw 1.3 million gallons of water on the first day alone on that. A neighbor saves a boy from fire. This woman smashes a cellar window, pulls a young man to safety. Children flee a burning house. This is 1947. 1949, mother and daughter rescued over the ladders, January 1949. Raytheon catches on fire at Joyce Pleasant Street, 1956. This is the Oakley Country Club. What would be a decade without Oakley going up? 1964. The New Year's Eve fire of 1966, warehouse in town ruined by fire. This was two and a half, at 50 Waltham Street. It was furniture storage for Lefkowitz and Son. February 19, 1970, Mr. Butcher opened Sundays. Ain't open today. A two-alarm fire on 206 Dexter Avenue. Three die in an Irving Street fire on February 23, 1970, and also sent 13 firefighters to the hospital. People remember this. I hear people talking about this. What a tragedy. Anything to say on that? That you remember? What? You lived in that house? Really?
Yeah.
Wow. And you said lived.
Yeah.
Lived?
Can you give me more details?
Did you? We were living in one of the apartments that was, the fire was upstairs.
And three children lived over us.
Three children lived over
right.
us. We could hear them screaming.
You were there?
Yeah.
Oh.
They lived there then, John.
Yeah, we did.
You lived there during the fire. Oh, sorry to hear that. Yeah, three young children perished in the fire. I feel for you.
What number?
Oh.
Is it still there?
Or
was it right
now?
No, the house is still there, but they've redone it.
1972, Francis Food Mart on Belmont Street. A series of fires in 1980, Summer Street, Hood Rubber Company, Edwards Road. Post office fire, July 19, 1987. Undetermined amounts of second and third class and bulk mail destroyed. If that happened today, I would have said yes. 2,500 pieces of first class mail. You were there?
Yeah.
Any story?
It's just a hot fire. A lot of guys were dropping that day because of the heat.
Wow. Across the street from the station.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I
remember this one, the Galen Street block up the street, February 22nd. I think so, yeah. It's a brand new... Was that Suspicious Origin or...
Lily's,
yes. Hearts Mason. It should have burned to the ground? We all hate Hearts Mason. April 16, 2008, John Schott and Corinna Baxic with these photos. Are you here, John, Corinna? No? This is on the Charles. And then can I quickly talk about the weird side? No, I promise. Just some story. I have to tell you these. Oh, no, there's a weird side. I got to tell you quickly about passenger pigeons because they're the most common bird in North America at the time of the Pilgrims. They lived in enormous flocks, and during migration, it was possible to see flocks of them a mile wide and 300 miles long, taking several days to pass and containing up to a billion birds. Some estimate the population to be 5 billion birds at the time the Pilgrims landed. The species went from being the most abundant bird in the world to extinction. In 1703, they were such a threat to crops, second only to the desert locust, that the Roman Catholic Bishop of Quebec formally excommunicated the species. Can you do that to Canadian Goose Father, huh?
Down over in the field over there.
I call it the chicken of the end times. During summer, passenger pigeons lived in forest habitats across North America. They migrated to the south. It was a social bird, which means it's not that bright. It lived in colonies stretching over hundreds of square miles and practiced communal breeding. I'll show you a photo in a moment. And here we've gone to PG-13. Early explorers and settlers frequently mentioned passenger pigeons in their writings. Samuel de Champlain in 1605 reported countless numbers. Gabriel Sagard Theodat wrote of infinite multitudes, and Cotton Mather, the pious one, he described a flight as being about a mile in width and taking several hours to pass overhead. Yet by the early 1900s, no wild passenger pigeons could be found. They disappeared due to deforestation of habitat, disease, hunting for food and sport. 57 years later, on September 1st, 1914, Martha, the last known passenger pigeon, died in captivity in the Cincinnati Zoo in Cincinnati, Ohio. And just here are some depictions, and if you can just see the magnificence of some of those columns of passenger pigeons. What a tragedy. What a tragedy. They'd land on the ground, you could club them, they say. And this is why I bring it here, because William Hammond, not William with three eyes, his letter from 1633 of Watertown says, "So many pigeons as might have loaded two or three ships, for 2 hours did we behold them. They did fly for 6 miles of breadth, so thick that they covered the air that we did think the first flight was 20 miles before the last came." He says, talks about wolf packs threatening cattle and the weather being very un-English. But that's there they are, and they're doing... they're making other passenger pigeons. This is about a woman who was found in her cellar, went 6 days without food. She was very discouraged, November 1904. A giant race of people discovered in Greenland, 9 feet tall. This guy was from Watertown, one of the explorers. As you know, 9 feet tall people live in Greenland today. We all know them. Windsor Club entertaining guests. The Windsor Club, a famous club here. A guy by the name of Tom Thumb gets married. Not the Tom Thumb, but I guess he was short, just like they used to call anybody red or whitey or lefty. They call him Tom Thumb. And I liked it because it said, 125 of the wee folks sat down to supper. Police baffled by strange men. Suitcase arouses suspicion of officers, February 1910. Basically, two men are carrying a dress suitcase. When they asked, the officer asked the men what was in the dress suitcase, he was informed that it contained clothing. Then the men acted suspicious. The officers ordered the men to open the case. The two men retaliated by throwing it into the faces of the officers and ran in the direction of the Hosmer School. The policemen gave chase, and what do? They fire several shots at the fleeing culprits. They're lost. Later, they're traced to a house.
Please, the time is 8:30, and the Watertown Public Library will be closing in 30 minutes.
Okay.
Come visit us downstairs if you have anything you'd like to check out.
Shoppers.
And we'll...
So anyways, on opening the dress suitcase, it was found to contain the bodies of 5 hens and a rooster with their heads chopped off. Insane man chases girls, finally overpowered by officers Brown and Burke and sent to a Worcester asylum. Young bear escapes, August 1910. Basically, a guy had 3 bears in his backyard that he had, only one got out. What's the big deal? Where was this? This was escape from the premises, George Russell Avenue. Russell Avenue. The other 2 bears have been very peaceable and quiet, but the other one was bent on escaping. The third one does not take kindly to captivity and has tried several times to escape. A quarrel has fatal results. Basically, a young O'Brien dies from a blow to the head from a milk bottle. These 3 kids work for the milkman, and one of them, who they call out as an Armenian, heaven forbid, hits James O'Brien over the head with a milk bottle because he was making fun of him, and he gets charged with manslaughter. Visitor from the air. Army aviators land their airship in Watertown on Sunday afternoon because Soldiers Field is too icy. The aeroplane circled 3 or 4 times and attracted the attention of several residents who rushed from their houses. It landed at Blyler's Field at the corner of Belmont and Lexington Streets. Army officers bound for Boston to take pictures of President Wilson's reception. They jump out of the craft and introduce themselves to stunned residents. It was the first and only airplane, I'm not talking about helicopters, ever to land in Watertown. The plane left one of 3 to leave Mineola Long Island Field on Sunday morning. Soldiers from the arsenal guarded the plane. The next day, Monday the 24th, they tried to get aloft, but they could not, and the aircraft was damaged. Repairs are made. Officers came back the next day, Tuesday, and worse damage as it came in contact with a stone wall, and the aviator severely bruised his arm. So the airplane was taken away by truck on Wednesday the 26th, meaning that no airplane, again, not talking about helicopters, has ever taken off from Watertown. In mine, I always get emotion when I talk about lighter-than-air travel in rigid airships. Ahoy! Behold the Los Angeles. The middle picture, that's when Buddy Hackett and Jonathan Winters were piloting it. thank you. At 2:30 p.m. on July 15th, 1930, over the skies of Watertown, the pride of the U.S. Navy dirigible fleet pays a surprise visit to Boston for the tercentenary celebration. It soared majestically over Watertown. It flew on line with School Street, coming from the Belmont side, turned seaward to the Arsenal, and then traveled along the Charles River towards Boston. Hundreds craning their necks, joining other citizens and peering upwards with awe. It was perfect flying weather. It was built in 1923, had 4,400 flying hours, over 172,000 miles. It was 656 feet long and decommissioned in 1933 after the crash of the Akron. The meaning, I'm telling you this because a blimp actually got retired and didn't crash. And my dad happened to look out in his driveway the day the Hindenburg flew over Boston on May 20th. Did you?
Yep.
Tell me about it, please.
It was in my front yard, and we looked through the trees over Gore Place, and we saw it.
Wow. The day it went to Lakehurst and perished. Wow. Just by chance. Can I hear your story, sir?
I just saw it midday. We had just got out for lunch at St. Patrick's School, and the nuns told us the airship would be coming by.
Oh, they knew about it. Okay, that you guys knew. Oh.
And you can see pictures of it over at Faneuil Hall at the right time, lunchtime on the
neat. Cool. Aha. A little bonus there. Some blimp talk. August 6, 1931, alligator caught by lifeguards at the bathing beach. The alligator was enjoying himself immensely when Francis X. Mooney... It appears that the alligator and a brother reptile were left here by the Florida delegation during the American Legion Convention in Boston. Here's an alligator. Come on, Marty, throw it in the river. We got to go. Fatal accident swimming at the gravel pit in on the McNamara property, East Watertown, a gravel pit in Watertown? Reduction of disease. I think that the 1937 saw 143 dog bites. In 1938, it saw 119. Whooping cough, 103 cases in 1937 in Watertown, 26 the following year. 164 cases of scarlet fever in 1937, 77 the following year. Measles, 181, 37. So 37 and then 23 the following year. Chickenpox, 154 and 37, 79. So there was a lot of disease, a lot of sick people in Watertown. A lot of pandemics breaking out then. Here's a good story, and I know we're getting... Police find two youngsters far from home. Newtonville four-year-olds reach Watertown on tricycles. Yeah. Yes, it is. From Edinburgh Street, Newtonville, to Mount Auburn Street, Watertown, by way of Central Square, Waltham. They didn't take the direct, they took the scenic route. And they were found calmly setting a course for Cambridge. And that's when the police overtook them. Okay, Edward Quinn and Joan Mullen, whose family share the house at 144 Edinburgh Street, began their tour of Greater Boston around noontime. They found that nobody pays much attention to you when you are 4 years old, so as long as you seem to know where you're going and take care not to break any traffic laws, you can go forever. And then Officers Frank Garofolo brought them home. Okay, and we're in the home stretch here. Just a couple more. Last passenger train passes through Watertown on July 9th, 1938. A huge turtle is caught by local anglers Sunday. A 75-pound reptile has landed in Charles River. That's August 29th, 1938. Officer fires at boy attired in girl's wear. Crossdresser at Saltonstall Park. News at 11. It frightens two 15-year-old girls, and he's trotted off to the insane asylum. And that's all I have tonight. I'm not going to go in there. Thank you very much. You've been a great audience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other thing is John O'Hearn, that he took the time to the chief. He didn't, wasn't he the one that wrote the book on firefighting that was accepted nationwide on how to fight fires?
I will take your expertise on that, Kay. That's wow. So he, a great firefighter. Watertown was very, very lucky to have him. Two great data points. Dave.
John, three quick pieces of information. One is Civil War, since you like to keep calling on Civil War. Before they got mechanized, some of the firefighters that were considered the toughest and the roughest and the most physically fit actually became the Zouaves of the Civil War. Wow. Because they were also considered the craziest, too.
Sure.
The other thing is the Stockyard fire you talked about, because mm-hmm. I used to live right on North, off of North Beacon Street, right by the Stockyards for many years. And just like the molasses disaster, for many, many years afterwards in the summer nights, you could smell the Stockyards for many, many
beef?
Years after.
Yeah.
The burning.
Really?
Beef. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And the third thing, very quickly, is I just happened to talk to a fellow named John Anderson, who's the president of the Medford Historical Society, this afternoon. And he was telling me that the Medford Fire Department in the old days, they had a set of horses that were trained so when the bell went off, the horses came immediately out of the stalls, went out to get ready to be harnessed and prepared to go fight the fire, and they could do that in 2 minutes, and that was the record at the time.
Wow. Great stories.
Yeah.
Yes.
Question, did Watertown have more fires than communities of its size? I mean, or
does
that
be
typical, you think?
All I can tell you is the journey that I took in the newspaper, and I didn't even look at all the newspapers. I can't really say that. I can tell you that this is a bustling metropolis, and it has its own culture. As we read the newspapers, the whole world doesn't matter. It's what's happening in Watertown. And you couldn't tell what's going on in the world if you read the newspapers. So. I think a lot of arson went on. I mean, a lot of people would insure their houses next day after they got the insurance policy, and it went on for hundreds of years. But I've never gone in depth. Marshfield, Mass., I've gone in depth to study all of their fires, and they don't have even 10% of what Watertown had. And you had a lot of factories here. Again, you're in the second part of the industrial age as well, where there's a lot of open fires. People would burn their fires, right? They take their hot ashes, put it into a wooden cart, and you put that out into the street into another larger wooden cart, and that would be stored in the basement of a wooden building.
Okay.
So,
Lynn is probably one of the busier fires.
1884. Yeah, yeah. Yep. And they had an arson bug in 1973 and again in the early 1980s.
Yeah, a
great book, Stephanie Shoro, Boston on Fire. What a treat. If you want a good book, Boston on Fire. One of my top 10 all time.
Would you invite people up to take a look at that?
Absolutely. This is a courtesy of Father Kern, a piece from Sacred Heart. Thank you, everybody. Hold tight. Glad to see you here. And I hope that you get by in this coming recession. It'll be only more 10 more years, so don't worry about it. Thanks.
We got the New England History Festival November 14th.
Yes, thank you. And refreshments in the back.